Since the Savior came to dwell among us, not only does idolatry no longer increase, but it is getting less and gradually ceasing to be. Similarly, not only does the wisdom of the Greeks no longer make any progress, but that which used to be is disappearing. And demons, so far from continuing to impose on people by their deceits and oracle givings and sorceries, are routed by the sign of the cross if they so much as try. On the other hand, while idolatry and everything else that opposes the faith of Christ is daily dwindling and weakening and falling, see, the Savior's teaching is increasing everywhere. Worship then the Savior who is above all and mighty, even God the Word, and condemn those who are being defeated and made to disappear by him. When the sun has come, darkness prevails no longer. Any of it that may be left anywhere is driven away. So also, now that the divine epiphany of the Word of God has taken place, the darkness of idols prevails no more, and all parts of the world in every direction are enlightened by his teaching. Similarly, if a king be reigning somewhere, but stays in his own house and does not let himself be seen, it often happens that some insubordinate fellows, taking advantage of his retirement, will have themselves proclaimed in his stead, and each of them, being invested with the semblance of kingship, misleads the simple who, because they cannot enter the palace and see the real king, are led astray by just hearing a king named. When the real king emerges, however, and appears to view, things stand differently. The insubordinate impostors are shown up by his presence, and men, seeing the real king, forsake those who previously misled them. In the same way the demons used formerly to impose on men, investing themselves with the honor due to God. But since the Word of God has been manifested in a body, and has made known to us his own Father, the fraud of the demons is stopped and made to disappear, and men, turning their eyes to the true God, Word of the Father, forsake the idols and come to know the true God. Now this is proof that Christ is God, the Word and power of God. For whereas human things cease and the fact of Christ remains, it is clear to all that the things which cease are temporary, but that he who remains is God and very Son of God, the sole begotten Word. Excerpts from On the Incarnation of the Word of God, Chapter 8, by Athanasius. Where demons reign, darkness prevails. Where the serpent reigns, the lord of carrion and father of lies, men everywhere fall into slavery, tyranny, and black debauchery. But as Athanasius so forcefully put it nearly 1,700 years ago, when the sun has come, darkness prevails no longer. Any of it that may be left anywhere is driven away. So also, now that the divine epiphany of the Word of God has taken place, the darkness of idols prevails no more, and all parts of the world in every direction are enlightened by his teaching. With Christ's victorious coming, the sun has broken over the horizon, and his cleansing light is everywhere making the darkness flee. But too often, the darkness-banishing work of Christ's covenant-fulfilling life, his atoning death, his triumphant resurrection, and his enthronement in heaven is bound up in strong cords, limited to the inner, private, and personal lives of men. Too often, men have considered his reign to be a partial thing, a thing limited to the family, to the feelings of the individual, or to the church. Christ may reign here and maybe even here, they say, but not over there. Too often, we have cut Christ's reign off from the public and political spheres, sequestering his power in our own reckoning to the private and the personal. But what happens when Christ's reign takes hold of the city fathers? What happens when the sun rises in the sin-darkened heart of city councilors, of judges, of senators, or even of presidents, kings, and emperors? What might a truly Christian nation look like? What might a truly Christian polis look like? Fortunately for us, Christ did not heed those who would limit his reign to the private and the personal, but felt quite free to take hold of the kings and queens and emperors, along with the peasants and merchants and slaves. In the midst of what is now called the crisis of the third century, the Roman Empire was faced with many and simultaneous troubles. There was plague, inflation, barbarians seeking to conquer, drought, civil war, famine. There was infighting amongst the Roman military leadership, squabbling over power in the divided empire. The Emperor Diocletian had divided the empire down the middle, establishing both Eastern and Western emperors to rule in tandem. In the midst of this hardship and infighting, a young man named Constantine rose up to vie for rule in Western Rome, grappling with Maxentius, another claimant to power. The two came to battle at Milvian Bridge in Rome, a bridge across the northern outskirts in the Via Flaminia. This battle would determine the rule of the Western Empire. Now, Constantine was at this point a pagan sun worshiper, a typical Roman. But the night before the battle, something extraordinary took place as he knelt in prayer for victory. Several reports give different details on what happened next, but Constantine reported that he had a vision where he saw an image with the words, "In hoc signo vincis," meaning, "In this sign, conquer," along with the sign of the Greek chi and rho, the first two Greek letters in the name of Christ, one on top of the other in the shape of a cross. By the end of the battle the next day, Constantine's opponent, Maxentius, was laying at the bottom of the river in his full armor, drowned like Pharaoh's charioteers. The 32-year-old Constantine emerged victorious, and he credited his victory to the Lord Jesus Christ, converting to Christianity. While he allowed for the ancient Roman religions to continue after his conversion, the emperor did much to promote the Christian faith in his realm. In 313, he issued the Edict of Milan, commanding that Christians be treated with respect and legal toleration in Rome, a reversal of the many and serious persecutions of the church which had preceded his time. In 321, he forbade Christians from making offerings at native Roman temples. He later had many of the Roman religious statues melted down and struck into new coins. He funded Christian building projects, including places of worship and Christian basilicas. He demanded that the lands and property plundered from Christians in earlier persecutions be returned. He appointed Christians to political office throughout the lands and even exempted Christian clergy from paying Roman taxes. Eusebius, the early church historian and 4th century bishop of Caesarea Maritima, recorded this quotation from the emperor in his Life of Constantine, quote, "This God I invoke with bended knees and recoil with horror from the blood of sacrifices, from their foul and detestable odors, and from every earth-born magic fire. For the profane and impious superstitions which are defiled by these rites have cast down and consigned to perdition many, nay, whole nations of the Gentile world." Was Constantine faultless? No, far from it. Looking back on his works, we can find many errors and sins, things done and things left undone. But it remains historically indisputable. God's work through the Emperor Constantine was one of the most powerful forces in establishing the Christian faith as the world-conquering force that it proved to be over the next millennium and beyond, even into our own day. Under his rule, the words of God through the prophet Isaiah seemed to ring down through the ages, undiminished in their potency. "Behold, I will lift up mine hand to the Gentiles and set up my standard to the people. And they shall bring thy sons in their arms, and thy daughters shall be carried upon their shoulders. And kings shall be thy nursing fathers, and their queens thy nursing mothers. They shall bow down to thee with their face toward the earth, and lick up the dust of thy feet. And thou shalt know that I am the Lord, for they shall not be ashamed that wait for me." The King's Hall podcast exists to make self-ruled men who rule well and win the world. Welcome back to the King's Hall. I'm Brian, and I'm joined, as always, by my good friends, Dan Burkholder, Eric Kahn. Tell the people hi, gentlemen.
Hello, people.
Hola.
Please never say that again. We were just discussing how Dan cannot actually say...
Should I call you Mister? You. Why are you gay?
The soundboard's back, baby. Soundboard's back. Okay, and actually, Dan was the one who said, "Eric, wait, do you have the soundboard hooked up?"
Yeah, I want that on record. On record.
Hilarious.
Dan's I said the people like it. I said the people are going to hate it, and I was wrong.
You know, it's like a dad who never wants a dog. And then you get the dog, like the little yappy dog, his friend.
Yeah. Eric, no. I also would like you to cut out Dan just said. He just said, "I was wrong." I need that cut out and just on the soundboard by next week. Okay,
what I'm saying. Got it.
Well, gentlemen, we've in the previous few episodes, we've been discussing statism, the green grove of statism that needs an axe, to be honest. We need to go into that green grove with Boniface's axe and knock it back, throw it down. Our cathedral of New Christendom cannot go up, will not go up in the midst of a statist people who worship the state or locate the divine on earth in this, the ruling class or in the state. We talked in our last episode even about a kind of response that might be tempting for conservative Christians to reach for to try and fix statism, this kind of cuckold, weak, lame conservatism. We said that won't do it. So what we're going to talk about in today's episode, because for each of these things, you know, we've talked about revivalism and what should we do instead. We've talked about all sorts of things and what we should do instead. We don't just want to knock back green groves. We want to build cathedrals. So if we were to look at a Christian society, if we were to build Christian towns, you know, even Christian cities, Christian nation states, Christian polis or polis, we can't get a straight answer on which is the correct pronunciation. So we're just going to go with both. I'll say polis, Dan will say polis.
Polis.
What would a Christian polis look like today? And so we will be talking and discussing in this episode some of the broad outlines of what it would look like to establish a truly Christian rule or a truly Christian view of politics, the civil sphere, the political realm. So specifically today, gentlemen, I have 12 theses that I want to defend and discuss with you today, 12 statements that we're claiming are true in the spirit of Martin Luther with his 95 theses on the Wittenberg Chapel door. We're going to nail these to the door of the King's Hall, and we're going to say, these are true. We believe these would result in a flourishing society and a flourishing Christian civil realm. So I'm going to begin, if it's all right with you, gentlemen, by just reading all 12 of them so you can hear them as a body. And then we'll go back through and we'll have a discussion about them. We'll defend, expand, and see if we might flesh them out a little bit. Sound good?
I love it. It's like the 12 rules of Christendom, like Jordan Peterson style.
Yeah. I mean, 12 disciples, 12 apostles, 12 rules, 12 theses.
Beautiful.
We're doing a little something called numerology, James Jordan.
Numerology.
I'm just kidding. We'll probably edit that out. Okay, so here are the 12.
Which means we won't.
People were joking at Breitheart that I say this all the time and then literally never do. If I say it's going to be edited out, that is the one variable you need to know. It will not be edited out.
If I say, please edit this out,
it actually will be because
I'll get fired from my job.
Trust us. The last time we edited a Dan statement out of the podcast, it was necessary.
A panicked look. And yeah, Dan's not the only one. I've said a few. Cancel culture is real.
There's a reason that we don't do this live.
There is.
Okay. Anyway, so let's read these 12 theses. Thesis number one: the political realm is one ordained by God, and therefore civil rule, though often corrupted by man's sin into an evil, is a positive good. Number two. It is impossible to get a godly civil government out of a godless people.
Are you trying to mix politics and religion here?
You know what? This whole episode is
separation of church and state, Brian.
A big old cocktail of, mixologist. Just wait. It gets better. Number three, godly city fathers are to rule with respect to God's objective standards, not man's subjective inclinations. Number four. Godly city fathers are to be just that, fathers, not mothers. Number five.
Ooh, spicy.
It's getting spicy. I was actually offended by that
number one. Number five. Because we love our neighbors, we ought to desire Christians and not pagans to rule over them.
What?
Yep.
Shocked face.
I'm telling you.
Common kingdom, bro.
Uh-oh.
Are we not funding the building of mosques now?
You know, I love democracy, so I will vote against that in a meaningless act of political tokenry. Number six, because we love our neighbors, we must insist that the authority of the civil magistrate is not unlimited. Number seven, godly city fathers must love their place and their people. Number eight, godly city fathers rule with explicit awareness of the covenantal nature of their office. Number nine, godly city fathers are to be defenders of the cultists. Number 10, godly city fathers are to uphold the principles of localism and subsidiarity.
Did you actually mean to say globo homo?
you know what? It was right on the tip of my tongue.
American Empire.
And then I threw up in my mouth. Yeah, the gay.
Why are you gay?
Why are you global?
Mister. Should I call you Mister? Why are you gay?
G-A-E.
That's right.
The gay.
Oh, Boniface option. That's right. He talks about the GAE all the time. Love it.
Yep.
Okay, what am I on? Number 11. Christians should live truly political lives, as the Greeks defined it, a life enmeshed in the affairs of the polis in a way that contributes to the good of his neighbor, not lives of barbarism. And finally, number 12, godly city fathers are to know what is in their sphere of authority and possibly even more importantly, what is not. For the project of this season to be successful, the project of seeing a new Christendom built, there will need to be thousands and thousands of Christian men and women who are equipped to stand for the truth of Scripture against the errors of both the liberal church and the pagan culture. This is one reason we're so glad to be partnering with our sponsor for this season, Reformation Heritage Books. Reformation Heritage Books offers a large selection of helpful and theologically rigorous resources on everything from biblical theology to history to blue-collar family discipleship, the type of library and resources that could make the kind of men and women I just described, grounded in the rich heritage of the Reformed faith. We'd like to highlight one resource in particular, their Family Worship Bible Guide, that presents rich devotional thoughts on all 1,189 chapters of the Bible, including searching questions to promote conversation and to help you in leading your family in such a way as to say with Joshua, "As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." Tap the link in the description of this episode to pick one up today. So those are our 12 theses, gentlemen.
And you are a pastor. I just want to say you're a preacher, pastor. If you felt like you needed to take notes, that's because you probably do.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. When I think in outlines. It's just how I think.
But you're clearly not in the SBC because you don't think in alliteration. That's the only thing missing here.
Way too wordy.
Alliteration.
Way too wordy.
You know, if we're good to our patrons,
yeah,
I actually have a transcribing service that I use.
Ooh.
This would be a good one to throw some.
Ooh, a patron subscription. By the way, speaking of Patreon.
Love it.
You guys should jump on there. We do an after hours every time show. It's like a sit down in the pub after we've had this conversation. That's the kind of conversations we have in our after hours show.
That's
with
right.
Every main episode. Jump in there. And you know what? We have a good time. There's a lot of Chippewa. There's a lot of fun in those.
It's just making fun of each other for like 30 minutes.
It really is.
But in a truly edifying way.
Some would say it's even better than the main episode, but you'll have
my son
Patreon.
Told me that.
Yeah, you'll have to be a patron to,
yeah, that's
to
right.
find that out.
Well, gentlemen, let's work through these and let's talk them over. Let's see what happens. Defend them, discuss them, expand them, and beginning with this first thesis, again, we said that the political realm is one ordained by God, and therefore civil rule, though often corrupted by man's sin into an evil, is actually a positive good, which I think is important for us to say in our current climate.
I think it's huge. Two things. Number one, I think defining politics, which mm-hmm. is often not done. So it comes from ancient Greek thought. Of course, the Romans are going to use language, Plato and Aristotle. It comes from the Greek politia, if I'm saying that right, and it derives from the Greek word for city-state. Most people in that era thought that the largest a city-state could become was 40,000 people. And the reason for that was that you had to be involved in the affairs of the people, you had to know the people, and you could not properly rule the people unless you had an actual local, real neighborly care for them.
Yeah, Aristotle even argued that the polis should be no bigger than the size that it could be, where you would recognize the family name
right.
of everybody in the polis, that you would know every citizen by face or reputation.
Which is basically true of the U.S. now, except the opposite.
Except for in the sense that there are 330 million people that...
You think about the discontent in America, so much of it is because we have these political leaders who, they don't know us, they don't care about us, and they don't care what happens to us.
They've broken
That's
how many of
polis.
These 12 theses? I think all of them.
Yeah, and Aristotle would actually say our condition is, it's not true politics.
It's not truly political. And that's actually, you know, number 11. We'll expand that a lot more in number 11. I think it's important when we start with this conversation about politics, because we are in such a universally terrible state of affairs. Like I just said, I think our government not only violates all 12 of these, but dances around on top of them dressed in a rainbow colored G-string. I mean, that's pretty much
come on.
That's
how the gay stuff.
Well, I mean, that's just so
it's
encapsulates
June,
it.
Why
Dan?
Couldn't it be like Chaps or something still gay but not so explicit?
I don't know if this episode's going to come out in June, but we're still in the thick of it. We're still in the gay trenches. With all of the, gay bullets being fired around.
Well, and if it is June and you sign up for Patreon,
right.
You get a gay mug.
You get a free Why Are You Gay mug. Funny, quick, funny story. I handle a lot of our orders. I accidentally somehow sent someone who ordered the Boniface mug, which is actually a serious mug with good art on it, for Father's Day for their husband. She ordered that one and I accidentally sent her a Why Are You Gay mug. So it's happy Father's Day, you homo. So I felt I'm sorry, whoever I did that. I won't name dox you here.
I'm
on
sorry
the show,
but, or thank you.
Yeah,
you're welcome.
For the record, I sent her two of the original mug as penance because that was pretty bad. But what I'm saying is
Because things are so bad,
I think one of the pushbacks, you get this sinfully libertarian impulse to say, no man can rule me. Civil government's just a result of the fall. It's all evil. It's all bad. And actually, biblically, that is absolutely not true. And in fact, if you say that from the foundations, you have just made it impossible to derive a truly biblical system of civil rule. If you treat it like a necessary evil, you've actually just you've taken out the feet from under your legs, biblically speaking, for how to think about what a civil government should even look like in the first place.
Yeah, and I think, just scripturally, where are we getting this? It's the same place we're talking about resisting tyranny, which is Romans 13. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. So we do have to confess, rightly, that the civil magistrate is a legitimate sphere.
Yep.
It's ordained by God, and we owe it proper honor and respect.
Even in 1 Chronicles 25, we see God saying, it says, "The Lord magnified Solomon exceedingly in the sight of all Israel, and bestowed upon him such royal majesty as had not been on any king before him in all Israel." We see things like 2 Samuel 23, where we're told the God of Israel said, "The rock of Israel spake to me, he that ruleth over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God, and he shall be the king. This human king shall be as the light of the morning when the sun riseth, even a morning without clouds, as the tender grass springing out of the earth by clear shining after rain." So God is describing godly civil rule as a glorious, beautiful, majestic sort of thing. And obviously, we're Christians. Who's in charge?
That's right.
King Jesus. He's a political ruler seated on the throne of the heavenly Zion. So you can't just knee-jerk react to ungodly civil rule by saying civil rule's bad.
You know, that's interesting because another sphere of authority that we're more familiar with would be the sphere of the church and how the church is to operate, right?
Yeah.
We wouldn't say that because there are a lot of wicked churches and there are a lot of really evil men that are acting as elders,
yeah,
that therefore the church should not exist. And you get different movements, right? That the home church, there's a sinful home church movement.
Yeah.
And doing a personal, private church service. And to make that mistake with the state, I think is an equal mistake of shedding off this hierarchy that God has put in actually to keep order and discipline, which does a couple of things. First, you know where you stand. You know where you stand, which we've all worked at a job where you're like, does my boss hate me? Am I doing a terrible job? Am I doing a good job? You go to have your review and you're like, this could go really bad. And they're like, oh, you're doing a great job. Keep it up. But nobody ever said anything. Same way in these other areas of hierarchy is that you never actually know where you stand. Mm-hmm. But in a good church, okay, bringing it full circle, in a good church, it is sweet to have good community, to have men that you respect and women that you respect and people that are looking out for you and that care for you. It is an amazing, fruitful experience.
Yeah.
The same thing could be said about a civil authority, the polis.
Yeah.
The polis.
The polis.
No, that executes actual justice.
Yeah.
Just justice. That punishes the wrongdoer, that knows the name of the people. And I know we're getting into other categories, but
the Proverbs say that when justice is enacted swiftly, the people rejoice.
Yes.
Right? It's a when you line
like,
up.
Wait, that's my neighbor. He was wronged, and justice is done. That is a good thing.
When you see the cattle rustler, when you see the thief repay fourfold at sword point what he stole.
Or the guy speeding.
Or the...
Eric, how dare you?
Get out. I'm about to go full Alex Jones right now. You will not pay the speeding ticket. You will have true freedom on the roads. You will live in a spacious ranch-style home.
The ducks are free.
You will eat the steak. You will not live in the pod. You will not eat the bug. Okay, I'm sorry.
That's the sec... Yeah. You know what? People probably missed
it. People love it. Yeah.
But I think there's actually a good intersection that you were bringing up to Dan's point, if you remember what it was.
Well, yeah. So I was making a point there that was very important. Can you remember what it was? Because I have another point that I think is different from the point I was making.
Oh, yeah. Hit it.
So the other point I was going to make is that you see these principles that are shot through every sphere of authority that God ordained, which, you know, the government of self, of family, of church, and of state. That what you need in all of those realms are good pater familias. Mm. You need good fathers, right? And so, again, to the initial thesis here, you wouldn't say that because there are abusive dads that the office of father is a result of the fall.
Well, feminists would.
Feminists would. No, God is a father. Patriarchy is inevitable. This is a good thing that is corrupted by sin. It's similar to the mistake that people make. I think we've mentioned this before, but there's a kind of mistake that Calvinists, particularly new Calvinists, can make, who are not studied and they're not very nuanced in their understanding of the doctrinal distinctives of the doctrines of grace, the canons of Dort. They'll say things like, mankind is a bad thing, or like, man is just bad. And what they mean is that in his fallen state, every part of what it means to be human has been corrupted by sin. That's total depravity. But what we're saying is that it's actually corrupted something that was good, which is mankind.
Yeah, we need to keep those things aligned. I like the middle part of what you said here, though. So you have that civil rule in itself is given by God, ordained by God, and is a positive good. But the middle is important, though often corrupted by man's sin into an evil.
Yeah.
And so we're acknowledging two things that exist together, you know, the good of civil government instituted by God, but also, and the founders in America knew this, people like Samuel Rutherford knew this. The reason, for instance, that you have the Constitution, that you have divided power, separation of, you know, judicial from the executive, legislative, the reason this exists is because we're saying, men are corrupted and corruptible.
Yeah.
And the problem is if you give something, this is where we'll, I think, end up going with the show.
Yeah.
If you give one thing too much power, the propensity for wickedness increases. So absolute power corrupts. Absolutely.
Yeah,
that's the problem.
It's not just linear, it's exponential.
Yeah.
The more power that is unjustly given, the more areas of authority.
Only one sphere.
That is given to a sphere that it did not properly belong to. It has a compounding effect. And Anthony Esalen writes this great book, Out of the Ashes, and he talks about, in one of the last chapters, the recovery of the polis. And he talks about this, that one of the problems, we'll get into this later in the show, but, you know, When you see the centralized gobbling job of the state authority start gobbling everything up, what it does is it just leaves nothing for any other sphere to do. It has no self-rule anymore. It's like, what decisions does the local school board have to make when the federal government decrees from on high everything down to the last math book that must be purchased, to what prayers are allowed or not allowed in the school? They get nothing. Like, they just have no authority.
If you recall back two episodes ago when I told the story of Mao Zedong and the Great Leap Forward, that's exactly what happened. The state gobbled up everything.
Like, when to plant the seeds.
Yeah, you couldn't even cook. You had to rely on the government for your meals.
Yeah.
Yeah, when to plant things and where to plant things.
When you could make love to your wife.
Literally.
Exactly. Yeah, every aspect of human life was eaten up by the state. Yeah.
Evil.
So you can see how that's exponential, though, you know, to your point.
So let's move into the second point, because this is related. We're talking about the corruption of the state into an evil thing. This good thing that was meant to be like the cool dew in the morning, that you come out and the sun's coming up and you're walking through the grass and you feel the dew on your toes.
And you're like, ah, and government.
The sun hits your face. And none of us have ever felt like that about the government.
No.
That is how God intended you to feel. You're supposed to come out and hear the birds singing and the sun hitting your face. And it's like, ah, I have the covering of a good king. I don't have to worry about marauders stealing my land.
Yeah.
I don't have to worry about someone enslaving me, because I have a good king. Have you ever felt that for one moment of your life? And the answer is probably no.
No.
And we don't even live in the worst of societies that have ever existed. Can you imagine being a vassal state of the Persian Empire? And in some ways, we've outdone them. But so the second thesis, though, is lest we focus our sights exclusively on fussing about the government or complaining about how evil the state is, we have to recognize that, number two, it's impossible to get a godly civil government out of a godless people. So Abraham Kuyper, famously wrote, in any successful attack on freedom, the state can only be an accomplice. The chief culprit is the citizen who forgets his duty, wastes away his strength in the sleep of sin and sensual pleasure, and so loses the power of his own initiative.
Mm.
And what he's talking about there is, think about it. Could a king by himself take over a people? Well, no, because you could beat him in a fight if you had 20 of your buddies there. He has to have the support of a lot of people. He has to have the will of some subset of the people. And maybe it's not a majority. Maybe they have a monopoly on force, or maybe there's some other factors playing in. But what it really takes to be conquered is for the people to allow themselves to be conquered at some point. On somewhere down the line, they have to allow for it.
Yeah, and I think, say in America, you know, early 1900s, you get into Franklin Roosevelt, World War II, New Deal, and then everything we've got today with, you know, jab of the state, jab of the welfare state.
Yeah.
Part of the problem is that in the beginning, it doesn't look like slavery. It looks like a carrot. And so in the beginning, it's like, oh, don't worry about your elderly parents. The state will take care of them.
Right.
So it looks like a good thing. It's easy. It's sort of like putting your kids in front of a TV instead of playing a game with them. It's just easy.
It's expedient.
But then at the end of the day, you know, after 3 months of that, you turn around and you're like, oh, wait, my kids are indoctrinated. It was really, really easy.
Yeah.
But now we've lost all this ground. And I think culturally that's been going on for quite a long time.
So one of the criticisms that I hear against some of what we're talking about is that, okay, you're saying that we should be involved in politics in some sort of way.
Mm-hmm.
And so you think we just get the right people in office and impose God's law on people. What would you have to say about that? Like enforced righteousness.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Well, see, biblical justice, and this is true whether you're talking about a human life, a family, a church, or something up to a nation state or a city state, the biblical view of justice isn't the top-down imposition in an artificial way of justice upon a people who hate it. Truly biblical justice is something that is born out of the soul of the people. The people act justly because they love justice, because they belong to the Lord. They have new hearts. And so while we will make a distinction later, even in our thesis here, that as Christians, we should want for our neighbors to have Christian rulers, not pagan rulers, even if they're not Christians themselves, because we love them and we don't want them to be oppressed or to be the subject of unjust laws. But we're not saying that our goal is just to get 5 or 6 people on top of America so that they can fix it, because biblically speaking, that is not truly fixed. Biblically speaking, what you would need is for leaven to go through the lump. This is why when we say we're post-millennial and people say, well, you believe in some kind of utopian view of Christianity, and it's like, well, hang on. What we actually believe in is foundationally that the Great Commission will be successful. We believe that Christ will return to a wheat field with some weeds in it, not a weed field with a few straggling stalks of wheat. So, but that's because we believe in conversion, the conversion of the nations so they could be discipled, and so that as a result of their conversion into discipleship, they want and they establish godly rule in the civil sphere. It's the exact opposite of that criticism.
Yeah, and I think when you look at even the gospel pictures that Jesus uses of the kingdom, they're organic typically. You have things like a mustard seed. Well, a seed is, you know, becomes a root system, becomes a plant. There's branches, fruit on the outside. Apple tree would be the same thing. really, when you're talking about the kind of government we have, that's on the end of the branch.
Yes.
And so if you have a rotten tree, you got to go to the roots. You got to deal with so much more than just, you know, what are we going to legislate now? The one thing I would say, though, is I'm hearing that a lot this month. You know, don't legislate your Christian morality. But by the way, everybody is trying to legislate our leftist, woke, gay.
It's not whether but which.
That's the issue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The point of this thesis is that if you want a truly godly civil government, it must necessarily be the result of conversion on a mass scale among the people, or at least the enough salt and light and leaven being present amidst a people that, you know, because, you know, 10% Christian population can have an outsized effect on a nation or a city. Absolutely. 20% doesn't have to be majority, but and what I'm saying is I think with a 10 or 20% very committed minority of Christians in a place, they could begin to see an outsized effect on the ruler, on the ruling of that, of those people, in the sense that you might see godly Christian businessmen running for office on local school boards, beginning to leaven the lump because they care more than their apathetic pagan neighbor,
yeah,
hopefully, you know, but you're truly not going to get godly civil rule unless it's the result of conversion on some kind of large scale across the board.
Yeah, it's something I was thinking about. When you think about, we really have a culture of death. Those who hate wisdom love death. Well, the only answer biblically to death is resurrection and new life.
Yes.
And so I think we need to be culturally aware of that, not hopeless, but to say, look, we have the gospel, which is the power to raise dead men to life, but that's fundamentally what we have. I wouldn't even say this is so much a dying culture as a rotting corpse.
Yeah.
Like, it already died.
Yep.
And this is what's left.
Yep.
And so as Christians, we need to be cognizant about that. And then, as you said, realize that the fundamental work of changing the government is a fundamental work of changing the hearts of the people.
We want people to love what is good and true and beautiful.
Yeah.
Not just to force them at sword point to obey God. Even though part of the job of the civil magistrate is to restrain evil, to restrain the wickedness of people who hate good. And so we're not going to say, like, well, because we believe in Christian discipleship, we're not about punishing people. It's like, no, that is what the state exists to do, retributive justice.
Well, and we would say the same, you know, about something like Roe v. Wade right now. I don't care if our country is a bunch of pagan leftists. I would overturn that sucker in a heartbeat.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But you've got people like Karen Swallow Pryor saying, well, I just wish it would have come at a better time. And like,
yeah,
even if the people hate it, we still will do justice.
The principle is, are good laws enough to save people? No, of course not. No, yeah. Good laws won't do it.
It can still restrain
but
evil.
Would you rather have good laws or bad laws?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I'm not an idiot, so I'd like good laws.
Yeah, I mean, you need to have the godly people part of this equation, because there are still laws on the books against sodomy, against gay mirage, against abortion, and they're just not enforced.
Adultery. There's Sabbath laws on the books in some jurisdictions.
Yeah, so just because you have the law doesn't mean that the people will actually obey it, especially when you have a government that won't enforce its own laws.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And actually, many of the efforts on the abortion front, for example, in Arizona, I know that Apologia Church, one of the prongs of their attack was to appeal to the courts of Arizona to say the government is failing to enforce laws that are already on the books that ought to protect the unborn from murder. And so they were saying, look, obey your own laws. That's a good law. But to your point, the people hated justice. And so they're saying, we don't care what's written in the law book. We're going to do what we want.
Exactly.
So that's the fundamental reality that you have to reckon with, is that if the people universally want evil, you could give them the perfect law, and all it would do is to heap up condemnation on them. It would heap up condemnation on them. You know, but as you start to move and you say, yeah, but what if you got 2% of a godly population there? What if you got even one out of the 20 judges in a region were just? It won't fix everything, but it will move the needle. It will begin to move the needle. What about 5%? What about 10%? What about 20%? What about 35%? So it's important that Christians don't assume this kind of on-off, all-or-nothing view of Christian governance, where it's like, well, we should give up because unless the people want justice, then we won't have godly civil rule. No, the principle of leaven still remains true. That we do what we can with the power that God's given us, the influence that he's given us, with the responsibilities that God has given us that are in front of us, and we entrust the results to the Lord. But we do so in faith that, no, really, in the history of Israel, there were several times where the godliness of one priest hiding the son of the king from the wicked usurper so that he would live when all of the other sons were murdered would go on and later establish the dynasty again. It's like the righteous act of one ruler, of one man, can really move the needle historically and change things. So it's kind of like a balance, I think, is what we're talking about. That on the one hand, we don't put our trust in horses and chariots, and we know that we won't get truly godly civil rule until the people are a godly people, right? The rulers are going to look like what you want, in a sense. And at the same time, hey, don't neglect the day of small things. Don't fail in your duties, your small, insignificant, humble duties, just because you don't think it's going to change the world tomorrow.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, because what I hear a lot of is, on the one hand, you have like Matthew Henry, which is a great quote, you know, as goes the father, so goes the family, as the family goes, so goes, you know, the community, church, and then the state.
Yeah.
But we could look at that and we could say, okay, so I'm just going to go home and not worry about the polis.
Right.
And so I think a good helpful thing to remember, like the Greek thought is helpful here, you know, the pious, the piety.
Yeah. Pietas.
That they're talking about is a duty to God and to man.
Yeah.
And it naturally overflows into gravitas, which is your duty to your polis.
Yes.
So I think that's a very Christian, actually, you know, Christianity would totally agree with that.
Yeah.
So we can't conceive of this as I'm going to care about one and not the other.
No, it's because, they build.
You know, the opposite problem has been true, too, of conservatism, where we said we don't care about anything happening locally in our state, anything. All we are fixated with is a national presidential election.
Yeah, let's get the president, guys. Let's get a Supreme Court nominee. And it's like, that is actually very important. You should care about it. But if you rail about that all day and watch 3 hours of, you know, a news AM radio, conservative AM radio, and then you send your kids to public school, I mean, you're literally an idiot.
Yeah.
I mean, because what you're doing is guaranteeing your own failure.
It's actually interesting you mentioned the word idiot, because it comes from the Greek idiotes, which was, I believe, it's basically somebody who cares nothing for the polis. It's tied to barbarism. I know we'll get into that, but
yeah, we are going to get into that. But I do think it's true. To quote Esalen, he says on page 169 of Out of the Ashes, he says the Greeks had a name for someone who refused the opportunity to live a truly political life. We're going to talk about this later, but he said that is a life involved in local affairs that bear upon the common good. Such a person was all bound up in himself, his goods, his pleasure, his work. I might add his 401k, his stock portfolio, his whatever. He was an idiotes. An idiot, and not because he was slow in the brain. He might be a quick-witted fellow and still be an idiot, still entirely focused upon himself.
Oof. Did you just describe, like...
absolute takedown.
An entire generation?
Entire generation of Americans?
Absolute takedown. Okay, let's keep moving. Let's keep moving. Number three, and I think here's where we really get into some serious meat.
Was just fluff, is what you're saying.
It was the steak fries dipped in the homemade garlic aioli before you take your first bite of that steak.
What are you doing, man?
Bro.
It's almost dinner time.
I know, I'm hungry. Number three, godly city fathers are to rule with respect to God's objective standards, not man's subjective inclinations. And so, without getting into all of the particulars of the 15,000 different views of civil law and theonomy, what we're saying is, at the foundation, we should all agree on this. We should all agree that Christian city fathers, that a truly Christian political rule would involve praising the good and punishing the wrongdoer, to use the language of Romans 13, where God gets to define what the good is that you're praising and what the wrong is that you're punishing.
That's right. And we would argue for, obviously, a Christian morality, Christian law. You have seen that in different spades in Western civilization. I thought it was interesting recently because I saw some people arguing about this online. And one lady from the LGBT camp, she said, we need to be celebrating LGBT because finally people are standing up for what's right.
Mm.
And I was like, well, hold the phone.
Hold the phone.
You claim to not believe in any objective morality. How could you stand up for what's right?
Yeah, what do you mean what's right?
And here's the issue is that as a culture, in any city state, any polis, any nation that doesn't have the rule of law as its foundation, the Romans understood this, it's doomed for failure quick.
Yeah.
And when you abandon rule of law, like we're doing in our country, you're like speed racing to the cliff's edge if you're not already there and you're hitting the accelerator as gravity pulls you to the bottom of the cliff.
Yep.
It's over when that happens.
Yeah.
Wow, that's sad. Guess we're all just going to die.
Not me, baby. I got a parachute. I jumped out of the Corvette.
Yeah, we jumped
Jesus
out,
Jesus, take the wheel.
let me read from Romans 13 here, because I think this is such... Romans 13 is a passage that's so often used. We're going to get into this in the sixth principle about no authority being ultimate or absolute save God's authority. But people use this text so often to basically say, do whatever daddy government tells you. And I think we'll see that's disingenuous. Paul says, let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. And I want you to key in on words like good and bad, and what you think Paul would say about who gets to decide what is good and bad conduct. He said, would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive his approval, for he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain, for he is the diakonos, or the servant. It's the same word as deacon, for he is the deacon, we could say, of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. All right, so let me give you a little thought experiment today to make us all throw open our mouth to see if what is often done with this passage could rightly be done with it and have Paul be sitting in the room and say, yeah, that's what I meant. Okay, for rulers are not a terror to your scantily clad gay pride parade in front of small children, but to bad conduct, like saying that a man cannot become a woman no matter how much surgery he gets. Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Then do what is good and attend the pride parade and wave your rainbow flag in its approval. And there you will receive his approval, for he is God's servant for your good.
Oh my gosh. What do I do?
You are gay. Mister, should I call you Mister? Why are you gay?
Do you guys get what I'm saying? Like, this is how people use this passage. I mean, I'm doing a reductio ad absurdum kind of argument.
Yeah.
This is how people use this passage.
Well, so backing up to an argument I've heard, and I would like to get you guys, you know, chatting about this, maybe why it's wrong, maybe why it's right. Mm. What about this common kingdoms talk that I hear? That, well, God's law is written on human hearts. There's a common kingdom. And so this legislation should come from the common kingdom. Do you hear that? Do you think that's a fair question?
I know Brian's thought a lot about this. this is typically coming out of the Meredith Klein into R2K stuff. I guess it's sort of, it reminds me a lot. So I was a classical philosophy major in college. And one of the things it reminded me a lot of, like we'd have professors who would argue from David Hume and other people that morality was only a matter of taste, right? That whole argument. And I would say, okay, well, my taste is that I want to murder you and steal your car. And they would immediately say,
drink your blood.
Well, you can't do that, though.
Why not?
And I would say, why? And they'd have absolutely zero answer.
Yeah.
I think it's very similar with the common kingdom. Look, here's the issue. We will be ruled by a law. You have two choices, righteous, unrighteous.
Yeah.
So you're telling me that you would prefer the unrighteous law.
Yeah.
They have to go there eventually.
Yeah, and I think where like your modern two kingdoms guys are getting at, or what they're trying to argue, is this, we call it like NL2K, natural law, two kingdoms sort of theory, that God, especially in places like the Noahic covenant in Genesis 9, established that the common kingdom, which is like the kingdom that is not the church, would be governed by natural law through human reason, and man's ability through conscience to access this natural law. And this natural law is basically just a derivation of, if by man's blood man is shed, then by man shall his blood be shed. It's basically like a derivation of eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, like sort of basic principles of lex talionis sort of justice, and that you'd then build from the state then should build kind of a law system that is just built on the derivation of what anybody, Christian, Muslim, Jew, could access through reason and their conscience. And their idea is that this is how God intended for the state to govern the world. This is how public ethics was supposed to happen. And so God made it sufficiently clear through these means that states could govern in this way. And I would just say, first of all, there are some books that you should read. I mean, there's some books through Ezra Institute that I think at length, like Uwe Neal's book. I can't remember what Uwe Neal's book is. Like, it's about Two Kingdoms theology from Ezra Institute. Brian Mattson wrote a book about this with another guy. There's lots of critiques you could give, but just briefly, I would say that number one, one of the problems with this view is that when you start doing that work of deriving law, like case law, from these common principles of conscience, what you end up doing is just reconstructing the law in the scriptures anyway. Because the whole point is, well, you shouldn't appeal to verses in the Bible and try to establish, like, even in a basically reformed way from the general equity of the civil law of Israel, like, you shouldn't try to establish a law for a nation from that. That should be natural law only. And I would just say, well, if you really understood how to do natural law, you would land on the same law anyway. You would end up with basically the same law as you do in Moses in terms of its general equity.
It's also interesting, too, though, because I think, like, practically this sort of pietism, common kingdom language, it can really only thrive in a neutral or positive world, right, where Christianity is, you know, it's positively viewed.
Yeah, in a world that Christianity built.
Yeah, that's right. But think about, like, Daniel. Could Daniel's brand of, you know, I'll say Christianity, but I think we all know what I'm saying. Could his faith have withstood if he was a pietist? And the answer is no, because he wasn't living in a neutral world.
Yeah.
He wasn't living in the world that Christians build. We are, but it's fading to the point that this stuff isn't going to fly anymore because it's going to be so in your face. I mean, every year I've been alive, this is the most aggressive I've ever seen June.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It is the most in-your-face, unashamedly, just full-bore out there.
Yeah, I mean, there was a video going around Twitter the other day of a man jiggling his breasts, and I know this sentence sounds impossible, jiggling his breasts in front of children. And it was a man who'd somehow had reconstructive, you know, he'd had breasts added to himself in this weird, he was like a transformer, you know, more than meets the eye. That was kind of what happened.
And Glocking.
Seriously. And he was dancing in this situation where there are children present and things like that. And you go back, I'm saying go back even 3 or 4 years, and that would have been, it would have been pretty hard to find that. 5 years, 10 years, you wouldn't have seen that sort of thing, especially in the national media.
Yeah, I make fun of the common kingdom language a lot. And the idea. But you're right, Eric. It's only because we're withdrawing capital from Christendom 1.0 that this is even allowed to exist, that it's even like a conceivable idea. But try to go to a place that's never had Christianity as a predominant influence over their laws or over their people. And if you've listened to any of our cold opens.
Yeah, the Aztec one comes to mind.
Yeah, the Aztecs.
It's obvious to us, they would say, that the sun is not going to keep coming up if we don't keep sacrificing slaves and ripping out their still beating hearts. So, of course, it's natural law, baby.
Yeah.
It is.
If we don't build a temple of the skulls of our enemies, then, of course, you know, the gods will be angry with us. Duh.
Yeah, so that whole thing is predicated upon basically a Christian worldview.
It's predicated upon a Christian worldview, and even more, like you're saying, it's predicated upon the existence of a civilization built by Christian ethics, which were not just natural law ethics. They were ethics that were derived, even the British system of law, that were derived through case law from Moses. They were derived from the general equity of the Mosaic civil law.
Yeah, fantastic point. So the other thing on point number three, so we're comparing objective to subjective.
Yeah.
We certainly live in an era of subjectivism.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We've talked about that with Carl Truman's book. It's all, you know, basically the moral, overriding moral, you know, directive for today is like, do what sexually feels good with right. your sexual identity, whatever that means. Mm. So my question is, talk to me about the subjective part. Why is this, I guess, where would you see that with statism? How is statism subjective?
Yeah. So, I mean, when you're talking about statism, like we said two episodes ago, you're talking about man writ large. That's what the deified state is.
That's a great point.
It's man writ large. It's like man's power, man's ideas about the good, the true, and the beautiful, man's ideas about authority, man's ideas about what civilization should be aimed at and how it's ordered. And it's making that into the god, the cultus of the system, making deified man, the state, into God. Again, like Joe Boot points out in The Mission of God, it's replacing the God-man as the nexus, the ladder of Jacob that connects heaven and earth. It's replacing Christ with deified man in the form of the state. In everything from Pharaoh's Egypt, where he's the son of the sun god, to the Greeks and Romans and emperor worship, to secular humanist versions of this, where man literally becomes his own god in his deification. And so when we talk about that system of political rule, we're necessarily talking about a relativistic view of ethics, of law, and of civil rule, because it's just man's inclinations writ large. It's like man's instincts about the good, the true, and the beautiful writ large in a sinful way. And so you see Jeremiah, you know, Jeremiah 17:9 everywhere, that the heart of man is deceitful.
17:9, yeah.
Desperately wicked. And deceitful above all things.
Yeah.
It's like, so when Isaiah rebukes the people of Israel for saying that light is dark and dark is light and bad is good and good is bad, it's what we're talking about here with the pride parades, where we're saying sexual deviancy, things that will get you thrown into hell justly, are good, and let's celebrate them with a parade, with floats, whereas things like Christians being fruitful and multiplying are bad because that's destroying the earth through climate change. It's any state program, therefore, that praises Pride Month and denigrates having children on a governmental level is just man's subjective inclinations writ large. And I mean, you see this in just today. I don't know if you guys were in this text thread, but someone in our church sent us a screenshot of their military email inbox. And it was like, of the 10 or 12 email headings that were shown, like 8 of them were related to LGBTQ Pride Month stuff. This is the U.S. military. That's government subsidized sexual, civilization destroying sexual deviancy. That is man's inclinations writ large. Man following his penis, man following his sexual desires as if they are God. And then when you make that man into the King of Kings and Lord of Lords on the statist plan, well, then you just end up enshrining man's inclinations, sinfulness, writ large.
Christendom Bible College offers a one-year certificate in the humanities for students who intend to pursue a degree, or for students who prefer to begin their chosen occupations upon completion of our program. Older students who never attended college or who went to a college where the humanities were less robust will also find our program stimulating and suitable. Located steps from the Ohio River in the town of New Richmond, we're unaccredited in order to remain free to teach as our biblically minded consciences demand. As servants of Christ, we won't wear the yoke of the woke. Instead, we stand on the shoulders of Christianity's giants, not to stew in nostalgia, but to see through the culture war's fog, to the glorious days of a Christendom still to be built. Our exceptional faculty are committed to the historic, biblical foundations of our faith. Come be a part of Christendom Bible College. Visit us on the web at christendombiblecollege.org to learn more. While there, be sure to sign up for our email updates and receive your free 3-chapter excerpt of our very own Dr. Frank J. Smith's new book, Race, Church, and Society.
Well, that's even an obvious one.
Yeah.
You know, but if you back up and look at, just examine the laws in the books, say that the state even desires to have a good thing. Like, we should have an educated people.
Yeah.
Right? That should be good, to have an educated people, right, to have people that are knowledgeable.
The Puritans were the first ones in North America to establish any kind of coherent schooling system.
Including the universities and colleges. Yeah.
So what they decided to do was, we're going to just tax people, and then we will educate your children. Why does that become a problem? Well, it becomes a problem because you're actually stealing from people because it's outside of your realm of responsibility.
Yeah.
And then obviously we have a whole host of issues with the actual education itself.
Yeah.
But just the way that they approached the issue and the solution was subjective.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was subjectivist. That's right. It was relativism. It was man inventing his own moral code and then enforcing it through a monopoly of force with the government, with governmental gunpoint.
Yeah, and then I think you can think of it small scale too. What happens in a household when a father rules by subjective standards versus God's law? Well, he's capricious. His children usually hate him. His wife can't stand him. His neighbors, he's usually a turd of a human.
Yeah.
Versus, the only way that you're going to get a just man is somebody who follows the law.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you're listening to this and you're like more of a classical Two Kingdoms type of guy, and you hear us criticizing common kingdom language and things like that, and maybe we'll make this clear later in the episode. I'm not sure where the conversation will go. But our criticisms of this are largely focused on the modern radical Two Kingdoms views and the way that they land in cultural impotence. Because, I mean, classical Reformed Two Kingdoms views, as they were seen in the 16 and 1700s, they did not result in a politically impotent or inactive people who were unwilling to apply the text of scriptures to issues of political rule. I mean, look at Calvin's Geneva. We're talking about this fantasy land of neutrality in the state where you're saying like, we should just argue for our ethics publicly from the natural law in Two Kingdoms. And it's like, look, Calvin had no problem quoting Leviticus in talking about civil rule. I have a quote from Calvin for later in the episode about some things that would be like, you know, Calvin, I think you could call a lot of the reformers Two Kingdoms guys on some level. I would argue that even concepts like Kuyperian sphere sovereignty that I think might be better ways of explaining some of the ideas they were getting at are actually compatible with reform, with truly reformed, historically reformed Two Kingdom language, and we're just using different labels for some of the same ideas. If you're listening there, you should know, like, I am perfectly content with the confessional language in the Westminster Confession or the 1689, like chapter 19 of the 1689. I'm perfectly content with the language of how they talk about the Mosaic civil law and the general equity. I'm perfectly content with that. And so I'm not necessarily interested so much in, like, having raging arguments about Bonson's thesis when it comes to theonomic ethics or things like that. I'm saying, like, we're not even close to ready for that. We need to figure out, we need to get rid of some of these obvious errors with respect to the law that, like, are massively popular today surrounding our thinking of neutrality, natural law, the radical Two Kingdom stuff that is just in the air and in the water and has informed so much of our political thinking. And so when I say, like, godly city fathers are to rule with respect to God's objective standards, not man's subjective inclinations, I'm trying to say something, actually, that a classic Two Kingdoms person could absolutely affirm and say, yes, brother, and a theonomic guy on the other side, a really, like, high-octane theonomic brother could say, yes and amen. Like, that's the kind of statement we're trying to make here. We're not trying to, you know, identify and land in the tiniest possible sliver of understandings of the law and public ethics that we possibly could. We're saying, like, let's figure out the basics, you guys. Like, let's figure out the ABCs of how to do Christian political theology. And if you can't agree with that statement, then it's like NGMI. You're not going to make it. Dan's laughing at me because I'm absolutely on a rant.
No, right now, I was about to make a theonomy joke, but theonomists, they take themselves too seriously, so I'm not going to do it.
Oh, that'll please them. Yeah. They take themselves too seriously, so I won't joke about them. I'll just insult them and then move on. King energy, Dan.
Lighten up a little
King
bit,
energy.
Guys.
Come
King
on.
Energy.
No, it's funny.
I think one of the things that, for my money, like, why do we go so hard at maybe, like, not classical, but the radical Two Kingdom?
Yeah.
And I think because pastorally for me, mm-hmm. It's because I see them doing what Gashmu is doing in the book of Nehemiah. You're actually discouraging the people from doing the work of Christendom.
Such a good
point. They want to go out and build Christendom, and you're standing there going, no, you shouldn't do that. That's bad.
That's not your job.
That's not your job.
Why are you trusting in the law? You legalist.
And you're actually encouraging the David Frenchism.
Ugh.
Like where you're saying like, no, transgender library time is a gift of liberty.
Oh, my word. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then you can say, and there's no liberal drift.
Oh, my.
And there's no liberal
drift. And Calvin would stand up and he'd be like, civil government prevents idolatry, sacrilege against God's name, blasphemies against his truth, and other public offenses against the religious state from arising and spreading among the people. And you're like, Calvin definitely would not go with the full David French.
No.
No. No. Absolutely not. So when we talk about these principles, a lot of them, we're trying to build a baseline again. We're talking about Christendom here. We're talking about Christendom. Christendom, we're talking about Reformed Catholicity, remember? We've talked a lot about Reformed Catholicity in this season, meaning that we fully believe that in the new Christendom, there are going to be theologians at some school of theology where, you know, God bless them, they're all the theological eggheads, they're getting together and they're writing a treatise concerning God's law as expressed in the Mosaic polity or whatever. And then there'll be another school that will be writing and disagreeing with their exact threading of the needle on it and positing their own thesis about how Christians should think about civil law. But both of them will agree with point three that we just said.
Yeah.
Both of them will say, but David French is gay. I mean, both of them will be like,
gotta at least have a starting point.
No to David French.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what we're trying to do here.
Will say that because the modern Two Kingdoms folks is like Christianity with a condom. They cannot replicate.
Oh, wow.
It's impotent Christianity.
Say it again for the people in the back.
Is that going to be edited?
No, that was so good because it's such a good picture. It's a Christianity that is, you could also say it's masturbatory. It's
I guess one could say that.
It feels good, but it doesn't bear fruit. No, I'm serious.
Yeah, you're right. No, it is.
It feels good, doesn't bear fruit. You're like, this is the thing, is that I think the future will belong to the people that are slandered as culture warriors because they're the ones actually doing this thing called building culture.
Yes.
Stephen Wolf made this point from Ars Politica podcast. He made this point on Twitter this week. I think I retweeted it, but he was talking about how I think Stephen Wedgeworth had criticized, you know, so-called culture warriors saying like they spend so much time culture warring that they don't build any culture. And Stephen Wolf was like, what are you looking at? What world are you looking at? It's the people that are slandered as, you know, culture warriors who are doing all of the art, all of the music, all of the writing, all of the fiction, all of the film. They're the ones who are out there building anything worth building, political engagement onto media engagement. You're like starting schools, starting higher education universities. And it's like, this is why I don't even worry so much about David Frenchism.
Yeah, so on one hand...
Can I just say one thing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We got a replay, Dan, of what you said before.
No.
Yeah, I do. I got a replay. Here it is.
I'm ready.
I'm your huckleberry.
Okay, you may continue.
No,
okay,
so on one hand, we you say we're not worried. We keep talking about it, though, right?
Yeah.
We keep talking about modern two kingdoms, radical two kingdoms. One, because we don't want you to be attracted by it.
Right.
Just here it is in its true light. It is ugly. Don't believe in it.
It doesn't work.
And on the other hand, we are not worried because of the fact that it is impotent. Like it will disappear in a couple generations because it doesn't produce fruit. It does not produce good fruit.
Yeah.
And so we're not worried about it. And we talk about it so that you won't be attracted to it.
Amen.
Mm, amen. Okay. Well, boys, while we're saying like wildly based things, like what Daniel Burkholder just said a moment ago, why don't we talk about number four? Number four is one that I believe both of you went, ooh, spicy.
I'm actually triggered just thinking about
You're triggered by it.
It again.
Yeah, yeah. Number four, the fourth thesis in our 12 theses is that godly city fathers are to be just that, fathers, not mothers. So one of the foundational stones in the political theology that we're putting forward is that civil rule ought to be exercised normally by men and not women. Your thoughts?
Yeah, it's interesting.
Why? Where are we getting that? Yeah, I mean,
yeah. Well, we were talking about Brian offline, but just how a lot of people have said, you know, what's the difference between like complementarianism and patriarchy? This would actually be one of the issues. Complementarianism generally wants to limit father rule to the home and the church, really, if that.
Yeah.
We're kind of seeing that come apart. Whereas in the patriarchal view, we're saying, look, hierarchy throughout scripture, we see the pattern that men are ruling in every sphere, except for, obviously, mothering, household. She is certainly the oikos despot.
Right. Not that all expressions of authority, period, are male.
No, exactly. So I think, why does it ruffle feathers? Because you have people who are like mad at John Piper for questioning whether, you know, a woman should be a police officer. I'm actually happy to come out and say absolutely 100% not. She is not to be in a protector, soldier-like role. She's not to put on the garb of a soldier. But I'm also happy to say she should not be the president. She should not be a senator. I think it's a blight upon America that we have the only kind of like quality people, and I guess there's a few men, but most of the quality people we've seen in the last 2 years speaking out, Kristi Noem.
Mm.
It's a blight on our land that it's the women.
Yeah.
That's not a good thing.
No.
We should not be celebrating the fact that a grandmotherly aged woman is in charge.
Yeah, and what we're saying, you know, and where we're getting this in scripture, if you look through the way that the scriptures talk about things like rule and authority, there absolutely is the reality that children are to obey their parents, which includes mothers. Mothers are to be, like Titus 2, like you referenced, oikodespots, which means managers of their house, like oikos, home, despot, like this very strong rule that she has in her house over her children. Proverbs 31, woman has a high degree of authority in managing the affairs of the house. But when you look at each of the spheres as such, like the sphere of the family government, the sphere of the church government, and the sphere of the civil government, universally in scripture, what do you see? You see that the absolute standard norm that ought to be there unless there is sin and failure happening is that men were designed to rule in their nature and are called to rule by God. So in the family, wives are called to submit to their husbands in a way that husbands are not called to submit to their wives. Fathers are given responsibilities by Paul in the household codes that are like, fathers, raise up your children in the discipline and understanding of the Lord.
Ephesians 5,
yeah. Ephesians 6:4, even. When you get to the church, you see that women are to keep silent in the church. Women are not to teach or hold authority over men. These,
yep. Yeah, which becomes a huge issue, because how could a woman's not allowed to have authority over her husband in the home.
Yeah.
How could she then go into a community and have authority over other people's husbands?
Right. And even
it's unthinkable.
It's not like, and we could derive this. I think the point you're making is really good, because you could derive this even just from principle, where you just say, if that principle is true, then on the level of the city fathers, like, should we put a woman in charge of all of the fathers then, if or all of the husbands? No. But scripture is even quite explicit. Isaiah mocks God through the prophet Isaiah, mocks Israel, and tells them that one of the marks of their judgment is that infants and women will rule over them.
It's interesting, too, even in Greek culture, there's a satire written about how the Athenian women take over.
Mm.
And it's like,
it's a satire.
It's supposed to be funny, because it's like, well, obviously this would never happen. And if it did, it would be a complete and utter failure.
So I want to ask you guys, I'm really curious about this aspect of this point, that why do you think it is? So we're talking about God building into the nature, God fitting his creatures for the duties he gives them.
Yeah.
So if God gave woman, for example, the duty to fruitfulness and helping her husband, as we see in Genesis, both of those things, then obviously he's going to fit her for it. He's going to give her a womb, which the man doesn't have. He's going to give her breasts that can produce milk the man doesn't have.
I'm actually confused.
Oh, are
men don't have wombs?
Well,
men chest feed, though. Gay stuff.
Some men
listen
menstruate.
To my new podcast, the King Hall podcast, where it's just me, because these gays over here. Okay. You see what I'm saying, though? So
yeah.
God fitted the woman for her duties, just as God fitted the man. Men are physically stronger than women, and he gave them duties that would require that attribute.
Less nurturing of younger
less
children.
Less nurturing, less agreeable, less peacemakers, more warriors. So my question is, why doesn't female civil rule actually work? And what happens when you put women into a position of civil authority? What fruit do you get?
Yeah. Well, I think that the reason we are where we are with women being in authority is because the state has swelled to a size to encompass things that actually women are supposed to be managing, such as like feeding people.
Absolutely.
Like food stamps.
Yeah, the government's taken their duties too. Yeah,
well, even so, medicine.
So even just the way that men are geared, the ability to compartmentalize justice is to be blind. The government, its job, the state, its job is to wield the sword of justice. That's why you see like the picture of Lady Justice, the statue. She's holding scales and a sword and she's blindfolded because justice is to be blind. And so you're not supposed to show partiality in that.
That's right.
And so what we have is not a government that executes justice through wielding the sword, which you also get things like, you know, military and some form of police. And I know there's a lot of discussions we could go down the rabbit hole, but we won't on how much of that is actually necessary and just. But it should be men. That's absolutely clear.
Yeah.
It should be men that do that. And so I think it's because the state has swelled to the size to where it is encompassing so many areas of management.
Yeah.
Like managing like a household.
I think management sounds like a word. I'm just kidding. I'm sorry.
No, the state has become like the oikodespot in a lot of ways.
Absolutely.
Of your house.
Yeah, they have stolen the woman's duty. They've stolen the man's duty. They've stolen everything.
And then they've said, hey, give us your children.
Yeah.
And we will take care of them. And you can continue to go to work.
Yeah, you watch porn, pay your taxes, eat takeout, and both of you go to work, send your kids to us. We'll take care of it, guys. We totally won't disciple them into our own image and the worship of us as God. Trust us.
And we won't undermine you, all of the money that you're making by stealing it through a hidden tax called inflation so that you have to work more hours.
And send your women to work.
And yeah, we all got a 20% pay cut this year in the last 12 months, roughly.
Love it. Well, yeah. I think that question, why doesn't female civil rule work? I think one of the reasons is because what you said earlier, Brian, she's not well fitted to it.
No.
Which we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. But the other part is when you take her out of the household. So to put her in a civil role, you've got to take her out of the home.
Oh, that's a good point.
So you're really pulling a lot of the foundation out of strong households when you do that.
Yeah.
What we've seen, too, really interestingly, historically in America, the Industrial Revolution, woman leaves to go to the workforce. So does the man. Children go to public school.
Yeah.
But what's interesting, Ann Douglas points this out, that she actually becomes more despised by the men. Because prior to that, she was like the pillar of the home. People realized, you know, Proverbs 31, they were praising her in the gates. Well, she's just another guy. And let's face it, when women are just another guy, she's pretty sub-rate.
Yeah, she's a competitor, which men are competitive in their disposition as a creational reality. God made us competitive because the world requires competitive men.
Yeah.
And so when women become a competitor with men, we tend to despise them because on the one hand, we are actually better than them at the things they're attempting to compete with us at.
Yeah.
Because we are fitted for them. So think about, let me give you an example. You know, picture a boot camp scenario, U.S. Army boot camp, U.S. Marine boot camp, and they're in the barracks, they're training on day one, they go out to do their PT training to establish a baseline, like how are you doing, what's the maximum physical effort you can put out, and all of a sudden, what was dominated by men only for a century or more, you look over and you see that there are some lady cadets coming out, and all of a sudden you say, well, look, they have lower standards than the men do because they can't do it. They can't achieve the same level of physical strength as the men can. But then the men eventually will have to submit to some of those women as their rulers, as their officers or their leaders. And it's like, imagine and it's not that no woman is, you know, couldn't have better leadership than any man. There's such thing as a really ill-fitted man to leadership and such thing as a woman who's highly competent organizationally or whatever. We're not saying that. But it's like, you can imagine these scenarios that are, and then bring that into every workplace in America. And you're like, yeah, men are going to resent the woman for taking their spot. And also,
it's definitely lowered wages.
You've taken the glory because, like you said, she's the glory of man. Woman is the glory of man.
Yeah.
Her fertile, helping, homeward-focused vine around your table, as Psalm 128, so, you know, we sing of. It's like all of that glory gets taken and put into this sterile field of the corporate plot where she's not designed to grow.
No, that's exactly
right. It also sets up a really interesting situation to where it's a net loss no matter what.
Yeah.
So imagine this. You have a situation where you're expected to be better in a lot of ways, and you actually lose. Mm. You don't get the glory if you win.
Yeah.
And you get shame if you lose.
Yeah.
You know, so that's...
In the boot camp scenario, all the men, it's like there's a glory in the competition, and one of those men is going to graduate the best. Mm-hmm. He is going to dominate, and that is good. He was made by God. There's one guy that goes in there, and he's like, I can run faster, I can go harder, I can fight better, I can shoot more accurately, I can lead better, I can inspire the hearts of men, and he's won renown. And he ought to lead, and he's going to be the head of his platoon. He's going to be the officer. He's going to be the guy that leads the charge and that men respect him and they die for him. And then you take that and you're like, now compete, and you have to compete with a limiter on your engine. You're not allowed to go past this many miles per hour anymore because, oh, there are ladies in the platoon. It's like nobody wins. She's certainly not winning. She's certainly not winning her glory the way she was designed. He's certainly not winning his glory. And so, you know, I think another thing you see is that women tend to be more agreeable. Women tend to be more agreeable. They tend to be bridge builders, just dispositionally in God's creation, nurturers. And so when you start to look at civil matters, you can see why it's only after women were given the right to vote, when women's suffrage happened, that all of a sudden, all of the majorly horrible things that happened in U.S. polity took place. Things like socialism and things like all of a sudden, why? Well, because of course, the nurturing feminine spirit is going to look at things like poverty and say, why can't we just all give a little bit more? Why can't, the schools, they need more money. The teachers aren't making enough.
Yeah. So then you see initiatives on the ballot. It's like, would you be willing to pay 0.32% more in tax property taxes to pay for starving children or single moms?
Yeah. And people are like, oh. The ladies are like, oh, of course. And the men are thinking, no, I earned that money. No,
that's to feed my children.
Yeah.
And to be left as an inheritance for my grandchildren. And the church should be the ones helping.
The church should be the ones stepping in.
Even politically, I think it was something like 80% of married women voted for Trump.
Yeah, actually, I think there was a study that went even further than that said it looked at almost all of the what a truly Christian conservative would look at legislatively in terms of candidates and policy and say how many of them that have passed would have passed if only men voted.
I think
it was zero. I'm not even kidding. I think it was zero.
Yeah.
I think it was like how many liberal heads of executive the presidents would we have had? It was like zero. How many? It's crazy. It's wild how big of a swing it is when you and what that shows is that we've actually in attempting to make women cut rate men. What we've done is we've actually divided every household in America. We've set because obviously. Those are some of those households. There's quite a few of them where the women are voting one way and the husbands are voting another way. It's like, this is probably the most based episode we've ever done.
Definitely.
I'm pretty sure that we just lost about 40% of our listeners. Listeners who are still with us, you're the real ones.
You're
the real ones.
Like, actually, no, I'm mad. I just want to see how much worse it gets.
Share this with your based friends because...
they'll like it.
They'll love it, yeah.
It's also interesting, Brian. I was thinking of something that I've heard your wife say. Which I thought was really good. Like, if women are being honest, this is not just like a stereotype, but it's a real thing. Women are designed with hormones. You can look at this biologically, scientifically, whatever. Their hormones are constantly in flux throughout the month.
Yeah.
Even hormonally, men tend to be more stable.
Yeah.
So kind of the old adage where it'd be like, well, do you trust a woman who's on her period once a month to push the nuke button? That's actually true. Right?
That may be the most based thing that's been said on the Kids Talk podcast until now.
I don't even know if I have PMS. I'm just always grumpy, so it's hard to tell.
It's true. And what the thin complementarian, what the even people are trying to cling to a vestige of conservatism say and try to have is this state of affairs where they can say men and women are the same, but God arbitrarily said that men should lead in the home and in the church.
Yeah.
But then for some reason, when we get to the state, it's like, but it's a lady senators, lady president, lady Supreme Court justice. Yeah, I mean, and honestly, let's be honest here. I'd rather have Amy Coney Barrett than many liberal men. But that doesn't answer the question.
No.
That's just, again, that's a judgment.
Well, yeah. And so it gets back to Tim Keller said it. I know John Frame has said it. a woman can do anything a non-ordained man can do. And what you're seeing here is that they're saying, like, outside of the office of pastor, mm-hmm. it really doesn't matter. There's no distinctions anymore. Difference. And we're arguing, I hope very clearly, the opposite of that. These distinctions apply to all of creation because they're creational and they're wound up in men and women's nature.
Yeah, I would say, like, okay, well, then why have men made almost every major invention, mechanically speaking? Why would men dominate in any show of physical activity? Why are men even things like the best chess players in the world, by far, by a wide margin? Magnus Carlsen, far better than the closest female competitor. Why, you go down the line and you find that there are certain things that man was fitted for, like singular obsessive focus, building, like physical exertion, leadership, things like that, rule. And then you look at things and there's like, and women are not just a little better, they are worlds better than men at those things to which God fitted them. And you can't just, they're not Legos. They're not four block Legos that you just switch out and they're just different colors. It's like they are different creatures.
Yeah. If you look at the nature of any hierarchy, you are essentially like reducing it to contention.
Yeah.
Like fighting. At some level, you are contending. Even if it's just protecting, so you're defensive,
yeah.
you know, instead of being the aggressor. But at every level, you are fighting. And that's why, you know, in the scriptures, it talks about, like, that a woman should not wear the garb of a soldier.
Yeah.
Is because, by nature, women are supposed to be nurturing. Men are supposed to fight. And I've heard Doug Wilson say this, so I'll attribute it to somebody else.
Sure.
He said, eggs are expensive and sperm is cheap.
Oh, which is the book? I mean, who wrote that book? It's actually a pretty common, it's a very famous manosphere book.
Oh, okay.
That he's referencing.
Oh, yeah.
Is anyway, that the book title is that?
The title is Eggs Are Expensive, Sperm Is Cheap. I'm pretty sure.
50 Politically Incorrect Thoughts for Men, Eggs Are Expensive, Sperm Is Cheap by Greg Krabel.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure Doug is self-consciously quoting that.
Oh,
or referencing that.
Sounds like a great book.
Sorry.
No, so the point is part of this discussion is not like, oh, well, you know what? Women are of lesser value.
No.
Therefore, they don't belong in charge. They can't make decisions.
No, that's stupid.
Yeah, that is dumb. No, the thing is, God, like you said, equipped each for the roles that he has for them.
Yeah.
And so the glorious thing that a woman does is she takes, you can listen to the Bright Hearth on this, and I'm sure we've talked about it on other episodes, but the woman takes things from the man and makes life.
Yeah.
So she takes sperm and she makes an eternal human soul. She takes money and turns it into bread and food and a home that is comfortable. And, it's a nice place to be.
It's nurturing.
And it's
warm.
Yeah. And so what she does, what my wife does on a daily basis is that she is tending four eternal souls mm-hmm. every day. She is disciplining them. She is discipling them. She is feeding them. She is nurturing them. That is, as C.S. Lewis said, all occupations exist to support the primary occupation, which is that of a homemaker. And so we're not saying that it's less than.
No.
In fact, in the right order, it is of far more value. That's the thing.
That's why men should be utterly willing to line up and go give their lives to be mowed down by machine guns rather than let their homes be taken.
Absolutely.
Because they're saying, I can go die. I've left my legacy. I've left my children. It will continue on. I've left my inheritance is there. And so I can go and I can lay my life down gladly and go down with my brothers and we can go and protect our land to death because of what's behind us. And part of what's the glory of what's behind us is women being women and men being men and beauty. And at the soul of the household, there is a fruitful green thing, which is a woman.
Mm. I almost wonder if that's why nobody's really willing to fight for what's good and what's true, what's beautiful, is because their households are howling wastes that are empty and they have no legacy.
Yeah.
And it becomes a completely worthless life.
Well, when you
because there's nothing left to defend.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal point. When all you have is like this androgynous sludge of humanity, like that's your population.
Yeah.
there is no beauty. There is no glory.
Yeah.
And why would I go to war for America when, quite frankly, any other androgynous country can give me the same thing, which is a consumeristic existence?
Yeah, for what?
I literally don't need to fight for this.
Why should I fight and die for some arrangement of tyranny over some other arrangement of tyranny and meaninglessness?
And they're the same because we've neutered nations just like we've neutered people.
It's like, would I fight and take up arms and die to protect my people and to protect this church and your families? It's like, wouldn't even be a question. I know any of the men in our church would be like, duh, don't even ask. Now, would I encourage a young man today to go sign up for the U.S. military? Absolutely not. I would say, do not do that. I would actually actively discourage him, because I would say, they're going to ask you to take commands from people who don't even know what a boy and a girl is. They're going to ask you to defend something, not even really truly to defend, but to go wage wars of aggression for the sake of oligarchies. It's like, no, don't go do that. There is something more worthy for you to do with your blood and your time and your days and your strength. And it's build households and build the church and, you know, build here. And then, yeah, maybe someday there'll come a time when there'll be a worthy city state for you to defend. And then I'd say pour your blood out for it. But, you know, it's like, and I'm not saying that to denigrate you who are in the armed services. And a lot of you got in and you're like, oh man, this is horrible. My commanders are wicked and they're stupid. They don't know a thing. You know, the high commanders, the generals, are all political hacks who are 60 and 70 year olds who are pretending like they believe in the woke agenda that literally didn't exist when they started their careers. And they're all just going along with it, all these 60 year old generals. And you're like, you guys don't believe this. So I understand that a lot of you, there's worthy work to be done there. And I don't want to denigrate the Christian men and women who are doing
just
that.
In a snapshot, what should they do if they find themselves in the
military?
Really
quickly, and I'm realizing we're going to have to wrap this up and do a part two on this to get through the rest of our statements. But I would say that what they ought to do is two things. I would say two directions. Number one, work heartily as for the Lord and not for men, knowing that from the Lord Christ you will receive the inheritance as your reward. I'd just say what Paul said. Work heartily. Work heartily at any worthy work that's in front of you. Be the best possible captain, lieutenant, first sergeant, whatever it is that you can be. Go be and do that. But then I would also say, have a spine. I would say, have a spine and don't be a pawn. I would say, be willing to lose. Be willing to lose, and God will take care of you, and your people will take care of you. And you are, if you're the type of man who's willing to stand up and lose your job even, don't worry, God will take care of you. You will also be the kind of man who can go put his hand to some worthy work. It's like, don't believe the, I know the military, the government jobs often get lull you with the security of the steady paycheck, the great benefits, the retirement package, et cetera, until it starts to look like, how could I feed my family if I didn't have this government teat in front of me? Trust me, men, you can do it. Like, let me just be the first one to tell you, to cheer you on and say, you can do it. You can get jobs. There is plenty of work that pays well in America today that people are not capable or willing to do. But yeah, those would be the two directions that I would encourage them. Yeah, so I think gentlemen, if you don't disagree, that this is actually a good breaking point in our 12 theses on city fathers and civil government. We'll continue this in next episode. We'll continue this discussion with the fifth thesis. But today, thanks for listening. We want to thank, as usual, our sponsor for this episode, Reformation Heritage Books. And do we have another sponsor for this episode as well, Eric?
We actually do. We have Christendom Bible College.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, so you'll have heard the ad in this show.
Yeah.
And deeply appreciative of both these groups of people for partnering with us.
Yes.
For this great work of rebuilding Christendom. They're very much aligned with us.
Yeah.
And doing that work. So we're excited.
And a lot of you have asked about those kind of options. So check them out. Go check out reformationheritagebooks.com or .org. I always forget.
Heritagebooks.org. And they do have there's a lot of new books coming out. Some new stuff from Joel Beakey.
Excellent.
New family worship guide stuff for kids.
I think a
7-part series, he said. Be sure also, Hard Men Podcast, check out the interview I did with Joel Beakey. That was really good. We talked about family worship, the Puritans, and building Christian culture. So that was great.
Yes. Well, thank you for listening. Thank you to our sponsors. Thank you to all of our patrons at patreon.com for helping to make this show possible and for us to put in the time and the resources that it does take to make this thing possible. And we hope that you'll catch us next time. Until then, we do want to remind you, especially in an episode like this, one of our mottos for the King's Hall is Festa Lente. It means make haste slowly, because when we're talking about things like the recovery of Christian governance, you look around at today and you go, it doesn't look like we're super close.
It's going to take a minute.
It's going to take a minute. And America could collapse and then something else start before anything that we say actually, you know, on the macro scale is implemented. So, you know, we understand that. We want you to be thinking, how can my household, how can my life be poured out to be pointed at these sorts of things so that God over time might bless us and our families and our inheritance, our progeny, and his church, which, by the way, he intends to build, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. So thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time in the King's Hall.